Bud comes down here and the signal works.
House Committee on Revenue for April 30th, 2009 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2749. Mazin, and then Representative Esquivel.
2749.
Did I say a different number? The number I meant was the number that's on the agenda, 2749. And also Senator Prezansky, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to bring you up to this bill quickly, this is the bill that increases the amusement device tax from $10 to $20. This is also dedicated for the funding of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, the OYCC. Amusement device tax is a tax that is on video lottery game terminals and other terminals that have prizes and so on, but mostly video lottery. And it goes from the $10 to $20 that is currently today, the $10, there is about 12,000 video lottery terminals. In the biennium, the $10 and the amusement device tax in general generates about $1.6 million, so doubling it is expected to double that amount.
Thank you. Gentlemen, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, my colleague from the Senate, Senator Prezansky, and I have been on the OYCC board for about 3 years plus. It is a program that we have for at-risk youth in every one of our counties, all 36. In fact, one county, I believe a couple years ago, we were the highest employer of kids in that county for the summer. We have a presence. We do work with the at-risk children. We make it available to where they have an opportunity to excel in the summertime and to actually be busy. We do, and we'll get into detail with exactly what the programs consist of, but I want to emphasize that these are at-risk children. It's kind of like the old saying is, if you've ever seen the advertisement with the individual with the oil filter. He holds the oil filter up and he said, "You want to pay me now?" Or he points to the floor and there's the engine spread all over the floor. Or do you want to pay me later? That's what this program's about. It's the oil filter. Because eventually we'll be paying much more with these children. So consequently, we have not had an increase in the funding for this base since, I believe, 1993. We've had $10 per amusement tax per machine in the state of Oregon, and we pay minimum wage. Minimum wage, as we know, has accelerated and doubled since 1993. So therefore, we are here to ask that we get better funding and secure more funding so we can get back at least to the 1993 level. Without further ado, I'll turn it over to Senator Prezansky, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to be before you today on House Bill 2749. As Representative Esquivel has said, he and I have had the opportunity to serve on the commission, on the advisory board committee for about 3.5 years. And it's been an opportunity for each of us to actually go into different parts of the state and see these young people who are actually have participated in these programs and actually seen what impact it has had on their lives. What I want to just point out is a few things that for the record, have already been stated, but I think they're worth stating again. The tax has been at $10 since 1993, so that's 16 years since there's been an adjustment. Clearly, we believe that there's an adequate showing and need for this type of adjustment, and that $20 per machine is not unreasonable. These facilities and premises that actually have these machines, they have a maximum of six. machines that are available to them. And so if you take those machines, you're talking about an additional $60 per year on those on the six machines if they have, if they're built out to six. The other parts I think that are important is realizing that we, the legislature, made a policy change as to how the program would work, and one that we felt, and I say we as a collective body because it was made before I was here, and I think most of us were here, and that was one that basically said that we wanted to make certain youth in the local area were able to participate in these type of programs. And so that has really opened the door. So young people not only can participate in the program, but they can actually participate in a more regional, local area, and they can actually have more buy-in and buy-off as to the work they actually do. And I think it's really important because as some of the kids told us when we were in Burns, that they could actually take pride in helping their own community through some of these work programs. And that's one of the things I think is a real seller for all of us, as Representative Esquivel has said. These programs are ongoing in all 36 counties, and so we allow all of our youth throughout the state to participate. There are two programs that make up the OICC, and instead of me going through that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to the Executive Director, John Asher. John has been on board, I'm not sure how many years, I know, nine. And so he's given Sal and myself the opportunity to learn through his experiences. And then he has a great, great team of staffers, the ones that we work most with, Doug and Jennifer, when we meet on a quarterly basis. We meet basically every 3 months, and what we try to do is facilitate the meetings throughout the state, so we have an opportunity to see these various programs and some of the work they've done. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to John Asher.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Asher, and I am the director of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, a program housed within the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. As was referenced, OICC has been around since 1987, and we've been in several different agencies, and we're happy to be with Community Colleges and Workforce Development now. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps was created by the legislature in 87 with a threefold purpose, is to establish a disadvantaged and at-risk youth program that would perform conservation work in the most cost-effective manner. We also want to protect, conserve, rehabilitate, and improve the natural, cultural, and historical resources of the state. Its third purpose was to increase education and training and employment opportunities for the purpose of improving work skills, instilling a work ethic, and increasing employability for Oregon's youth. To accomplish these goals, OICC has created two basic programs, and I've distributed, I think, our annual report, so all of the particulars are included. I just want to highlight a few things. The first program is our Summer Conservation Corps program. We will have at least one crew funded by OYCC in every county in the state. It could be a small crew of five up to Central Oregon having 117 youth. These are locally based programs. We leverage our dollars really well for each state dollar. Last summer, the local programs leveraged about $4, and that's why we can serve such great numbers, because our dollars are very small. Our second program is the Community Stewardship Corps program. It's fairly unique to Oregon. We work with about 24 high school programs during the school year. The youth are referred from traditional high schools, counselors, Workforce Investment Act providers. We serve quite a few dropouts and out-of-school youth. We bring them back in. Some of our programs are GED option programs. The youth will spend about 40% of the time in the field, 40% of their time in the classroom, and 20% integrating those two pieces together. OICC also requires our school year programs to provide scholarships for successful participants. Successful participants can earn $125 a month to a maximum of $1,500. And since 92, when we started the school year program, we've awarded about $1.86 million to youth for use at any college or trade school throughout the country, actually. And so we're really proud of that. Like I said, the annual report has a lot of the specifics, so you'll be feel free to go through and ask any questions if you have them on anything in the annual report. We also provide training for crew leaders. We have a natural resource curriculum that was recently developed working with the Business Education Compact, and it's built to Department of Ed standards that we offer not only to OYCC programs, but actually anybody that would like a copy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, one other thing before we take questions, if we could. I think it's important for the committee to understand, because you may have read some of the stuff in the newspaper, with the stimulus money that's coming into the state, we have had an infusion of money that will actually reach out to many, many youth beyond what we would ever hope to be able to do because of the influx of the stimulus money. But I want to make certain everyone understands that is basically, call it a one-time shot. It's money that will be available this summer, next school year, and the following summer. So what we're here for and asking this committee to do is to move forward a funding source that will be ongoing beyond the stimulus money so we can maintain the quality services that we have and hopefully opening it up on a regular basis to additional youth.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to follow up with what Senator Przanski just stated, that the stimulus money is also funneled through the Forest Service. We've made an agreement with the Forest Service on this particular money. It's about $6 point some odd million, $2.5 million, something like that. It's a one-time basis. I hope each and every one of you have an opportunity when we do have our meetings in your districts, in your counties, that you do attend those meetings. And more importantly, I hope you take the field trip with us when we go out and see these youths when they are working in the summertime. There's nothing more gratifying as an individual to look into the eyes of a young person that has just made a trail, did work in an estuary, whether it be on the coast, whether it be something to do with a river, and did some great work in the pride that's in their eyes. When you see that, you'll understand why the success of this program is so great.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, of course, for all three of you and John in particular. You mentioned that 40% of the time spent in the field, 40% of the time is spent in the classroom, and 20% is spent integrating the two. So I guess tell me what that 20% looks like, because quite frankly, I would have assumed that the time spent in the field was integrating those two.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Springer, it is kind of confusing. The work is tied with what they're learning in school as a whole. That 20% figure would be, you could think of it as how they would directly teach how the project is going to relate to something, say, in mathematics. So they would learn area or perimeter measurement in the classroom and get the concept down there. And then when they went into the field, if they were like removing invasive species, that's where they would use what they learned in the classroom, and on the ground in the field was where they'd measure out their accomplishments for the day or for the project as a whole.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I have a series of questions.
Please, go ahead. Yes, you may ask some of mine.
How are these children chosen? By what method are they identified, and what is the sort of application process that they go through for these? And there's really three different sort of programs, that, just reading through here.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, each program is locally designed and implemented. So each program has a little different focus on how they recruit and who they recruit. If you look through the report and you see who our programs are, you'll see individual high schools, traditional schools, school districts, charter schools, Workforce Investment Act providers. Each one of them has a little different clientele that they work with. So a Workforce Investment Act provider might use the Federal Department of Labor eligibility requirements for the most needy. Mm-hmm. Other schools may have counselors that will identify youth that are struggling in the traditional environment that need a different way to learn and have a different opportunity to show their skills. Hands-on learning is great for some kids. Some kids are fine in a traditional classroom, and this is just an option for them. So,
yes, please, yes.
So if different districts and different areas can kind of, that's a good thing, but how do you, as overseer, stay true to your mission that this is directed at a specific population and ensure that the programs sort of on the ground don't turn into a great summer job for kids who are going to get a great summer job anyway or be eligible for it? And I guess from up here, how do you keep it at the at-risk level is my question.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, our proposal process includes our statutory requirements, one of those being that we serve 75% at-risk and disadvantaged youth. Our definition of at-risk and disadvantaged youth is in here in the annual report, but basically it was developed by the advisory committee in 1997, and it identifies youth that are at risk of not meeting the expectations of their community, whether it be social, economic, educational. And so in each area of the state, it will look a little different. Gang problems are a large piece in Malheur County, not so much in Douglas County. But in Douglas County, the socioeconomic level is really low. So those are the organizations that we work with, identify those youth that could most benefit from our program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think in answer to your question as to what they do, we rely on the programs themselves to comply with the state rules and laws in the application they put forward, and they actually are signing on the dotted line that the children that are represented within their program meet the criteria that have been set by the Corps.
And I guess I probably should be on Ways and Means, Senator, the way I'm grilling this poor guy, because this is a wonderful program. But
don't sound higher here.
Okay. What measurements do you use to say this is success? I'm all about measurements. I might as well be on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm going to give you an example. We had a meeting in St. Helens. We had some kids from an alternative school that we discussed and talked with, and they were also eligible for summer programs. Three of these students were so outstanding, you can't believe it. Intelligent, articulate, great personalities. All three young ladies were getting ready to go to the University of Oregon. Impressive. And I asked, what are you doing here? Why are you in this? The answer is real simple. Because here they care. They don't in a public school. The only thing they do in a public school is move us through. That's what we're here. We're here to make a difference for these kids. Those kids would probably have dropped out of school if we hadn't had programs like we do. And all three of those young ladies were getting ready to go to the University of Oregon. And it was very impressive because it was obvious that they should go to the University of Oregon. It was obvious they were intelligent, but they didn't fit the normal school bricks and mortar. And that's what these programs are about. These kids are at risk. And we would have lost those three individuals, for sure. But this program got them on the right path.
One more question.
Yes, please.
And this is for staff. When was the last time this tax was raised? And when did this, was this, is, has this program always been funded under this? And is it only estate video lottery games that are taxed, not tribal lottery games or video games? You know, I mean, you can get back to me on that, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we can answer some of those questions. It's 1993 when the tax was imposed. My understanding was based on the lottery actually coming in conception. What was part of that? John might be able to give you that information. No, it does not include tribal because that's under interstate compact agreements.
Has anybody asked about... Well, I'll ask in... It seems to me if you could do it as a sales tax.
Well, you are, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you are talking to sovereign nation. And,
but they're purchasing for use in our state.
Yeah. If you want to respond, go ahead, Representative, or Senator.
No,
Okay. I'm just asking.
Yeah. Sometimes we don't get what we want, Representative.
Well, but that doesn't mean that we can't keep asking.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree with that.
I tend to get a lot more when I keep asking.
That's true.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to ask to be excused. I've got to start judiciary at 8:30.
Thank you, Senator. We appreciate very much your attendance this morning, and have a great meeting.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I didn't have to answer anything, Mr.
Yes, that's right.
No. When was it last raised?
1993.
So it's never been raised since 1993.
Right.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. First, I have to point out, I think my children have been schooled by Representative Berger, having learned that they don't always get what they want, but that doesn't seem to keep them from continuing to ask. I had a question. On page 8, where it talks about the community stewardship core, the gender disparity is pretty striking. Can you talk a little bit about why girls and young women are so underrepresented and whether or not there are efforts to make sure that girls and young women, like those that Representative Esquivel just spoke about, might also be able to benefit equally from this program?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser. We struggle to maintain a 50%. That's what we would like to see. And that's what we encourage strongly. Oregon is a very broad state. It's very large, very diverse population. When we look at the programs in the more urban areas, our numbers for females usually goes way up. In some of the rural areas, maybe cultural norms might be part of it. Having young ladies out digging in the dirt might not be seen the same way as it is possibly with a stronger environmental ideals of more urban areas. We've consistently been about the same percentages. There are some areas that have really increased the numbers of females, and in some areas they've decreased some, but we are working on that, trying to find different avenues that females would respond to more. And some of the programs are a 50-50 split. Sometimes counselors will more readily recommend males than females. For our summer programs, some of our programs just do a lottery, and they pull 50-50. And that works out well when you can do it that way.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
No follow-up. If some of your programs are 50-50 or better, that would not speak well of some of the others if statewide your percentage of females is 29%. And I recognize that populations are diverse across the state, but I would imagine that in rural Oregon and eastern Oregon that females still make up about 51% of the population. I assume they have girls and women in rural parts of the state, and that it would be a leadership opportunity for the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps to encourage in its application process and its staff development that absolutely girls should be out digging in the dirt and climbing in trees and pulling out noxious weeds. That's just, this number is really troubling in 2009, and I hope that it's not true that counselors aren't recommending young girls and women and sending the message to them that these are activities they shouldn't be engaged in, because they should.
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Gelser, as I said, we really encourage our programs to engage females.
Do you have a benchmark, like a goal to maybe get to a third, 33%, given the 51% gender split in the state? Can you look at progress across the state?
In some areas, we will see progress. Very good question, Representative.
Part of the point of her question, of course, is to get you thinking and goading.
I understand that, Chair Bernhardt. We, OYCC participants aren't sentenced to the program. It's actually they're referred or they show up to the programs. I would like to see more females show up to the programs. But in some areas, larger numbers of females, they're very hard to recruit in some areas. They're eligible in every county and every school to apply.
And just one follow-up. I mean, I heard two different words there, show up and recruit, and there's two differences. And I think the recruiting helps people to show up. And I understand that everybody is eligible, but sometimes who's eligible and where the effort actually goes in. This looks like a failure in an otherwise good program, and I would hope that when the program comes back again, there would be a plan for actively reaching out to these young women. We have young women and girls that are at risk. We have young women and girls that grow up to live in poverty and to become single moms, and they need this type of work experience and support. And if we have a program like this and we're looking at increasing the funding and increasing a tax, we should make sure that we are not perpetuating gender stereotypes and that we aren't passively discouraging young women from benefiting from this. This is deeply troubling, and I hope when you come back we can hear some very concrete strategies for how you're going to fix this glaring problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I think that this is something that, I'll be honest with you, it went right by me. Senator Prozanski and I will bring this up to the next board. We will come in the 2008 when we get back in this building, and we will have crafted a plan to approach this. This is a good point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've known some people that have participated in the program, and so this question has nothing to do with questioning the validity of it, because I think it's a good program. I'm the mom that marched my 8-year-old son, but be guaranteed if he was a girl, he would have done the same thing, and that is marched him down to the fish hatchery down the road, 2 miles down the road when he was 8 years old, and said, "Will you give him a job one morning a week?" And he's starting his fifth summer down there this year, and he needs to learn to work. We all need to learn to work. So there's a great value in this program in that right there. And this program is about jobs, which is a good thing. But hear me say, if my son was a girl, he would have been marched down there to do the very same work. So my question is, I don't know if this is more for Mazin or not. This is about jobs, and quite frankly, in this session, most every decision for me is about jobs. So as I look at the 100% increase from $10 to $20, I'm not a video poker player, and I'll just be upfront about that. So I'm trying to think about what this does to businesses that have video poker machines in them. I mean, are we talking about a $50 a year increase, or are we talking about into the thousands of dollars? What would be the average increase, and would this translate into building jobs over here at the cost of jobs over here, and do we need to find a balance? So So who wants to take that?
Mr. Chair,
anybody.
As we've stated before, it's a maximum of 6 machines, so it's an impact of $60 per entity.
Thank you. That addresses it.
Doesn't
did you want to weigh in?
Yes, I concur.
I must have missed that, and I apologize.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to stake a little bit away back to what the purpose of this is, and it's at-risk kids.
Mm-hmm.
And all due respect, Representative Gelzer, if you look at the at-risk kids, look at the gangs on the street corner, they're 90% boys. And I think we have to be careful when we're trying to point out to make something equal in gender, that we don't lose the purpose of at-risk kids. I don't want to say we want equal number of this, that, or the other, when that isn't the at-risk population.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Why don't you make one remark and then let's move on?
I would make two remarks and my one remark. 100% of pregnant teenagers are girls, and the higher percentage of drug and alcohol use among young people and the age at which it starts is higher among young women. So while young women may not be in gangs, they are more likely to make choices that impact their lives and the lives of their children for generations. And they show up at risk in different ways, but they are just as at risk, if not more at risk, than young men.
And may I just add that it is a truism that genders tend, not always, but tend to respond differently to family traumas and a whole variety of other stressors. Boys tend to act out more in very public ways. Girls tend to do it in more private ways, although those are stereotypes and they're not always true. I suspect, without knowing this, that some of these programs tend to attract people who tend to, when they have difficulties, tend to act out in one way rather than the other. And that might be part of the difference, although I do believe it's very important for us to be looking carefully and for the director to be looking carefully at why we have a gender imbalance and be able to, if it continues, to be able to explain why. And if on evaluation he thinks that it ought to change, then he can figure out ways to go about doing that. I believe that's a fair summary of maybe if I can integrate what the two of you have said, but
I said I don't think we disagree.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Are there other questions? I have several. If there are not others, you've mentioned that you tend to be able to leverage other dollars. That went by pretty fast. Would you describe that in a little more detail?
Sure, Bernhardt. If you would look at the last 3 or 4 pages
yes.
of the annual report, you'll find 535, I believe, organizations, agencies, individuals, nonprofits that supported our programs in the year that this annual report represents. It's not all cash. There's a lot of in-kind involved. Some organizations will donate fuel. Some will pay for the crew leader. Some will teach and train the youth on the jobs.
Vehicles.
Vehicles is a big issue. We place youth in many, many different types of learning environments, and all of it collectively coming together helps us serve the number of kids that we can serve.
Thank you. And then for me, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the programs in Lane County. And let me tell you that I believe it's the Northwest Youth Corps is actually located in Eugene, if I've got the right name, and is in my district. And if that's the case, I've actually been to some of their spaghetti dinners and met some of the kids, and so I know a little bit about that program. Is that one of your programs?
Yes, it is, Chair Barnhart. We have three fantastic programs that operate both summer programs and school year programs, if we have the money. This last cycle, we only had enough money to fund one of the three programs that we have during the school year during the summer. We support currently Northwest Youth Corps in Eugene, Looking Glass Youth and Family Services. Our program is called Lane Metro Youth Corps. And we also support Kennedy Alternative School in Cottage Grove. Mm-hmm. Both Looking Glass's program and Northwest Youth Corps have been with OYCC pretty much from the beginning. We added Kennedy School approximately 3 years ago, and they're just running an awesome program. All three of them run really good programs.
And where is Kennedy?
In Cottage Grove.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And I notice also that you have some in Eastern Oregon, in Harney, Malheur, Baker, Grant, Union, Umatilla counties. Could you describe any of those briefly?
Yes, I can, Chair Barnhart. In Umatilla and Moro counties during the summer, our provider is called CAPCO. It's Community Action Program of East Central Oregon. It's the Workforce Investment Act provider. We'll currently have crews out of Hermiston, Heppner, and we have had crews in Ione before. In Union, Baker, Grant, Harney, and I'm forgetting one. I apologize. And Wallawa. Our programs are with Training and Employment Consortium. Those are the local Workforce Investment Act areas. They're spread between two regions. Each of those counties is county-based. They each have a different name. They each have different staff, and their projects and partners are different. They have the same fiscal agent. Just wonderful, wonderful crews.
Thank you. And now, are you essentially a funding agency, or do you provide some expertise in helping to develop or maintain programs? What exactly is it that your office does?
Chair Barnhart, we are a funding agency. We do not hire people directly. We work with people that apply to us for funding, and we basically sell a model, and we train crew leaders and teachers and staff to that model. We provide a lot of technical assistance, especially to new programs, as far as how to make those relationships that added up to 535 partners. Each community will have a different resource base. And a lot of the questions we get is, say, with a new Forest Service district, they might not know how to develop an agreement with a youth corps program. And so we have the ability to get uninformed staff with the Forest Service together with informed staff that are currently doing it and letting their peers teach them how to develop a collective agreement or a participating agreement.
Thank you. Does that generate any other questions for other members? Thank you very much. I really appreciate your testimony. I can tell you that my observation of the program I know about is that it is an excellent program. It does a great job with the kids who, I think one of you described them, are more likely to be hands-on learners and less likely to be people who find it satisfying to sit in a classroom. And being able to combine those two makes those particular young people successful in school when they might otherwise not be. I met a number of families from all over the Lane County in going to those events that I described, where parents obviously were extremely pleased with the program because they had been fit to be tied trying to deal with their children in the regular traditional school system, and had discovered this program usually through the help of a school counselor, and were finding themselves with great success, and kids whose morale had improved a lot. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill this morning? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2749 and open a work session on House Bill 2069. Chris, we have a series of amendments, and then I think we have some people we want to make sure we hear from this morning. Colleagues, this bill is not ready to work today, but we need to bring it back periodically so we can have some conversations about it, so we can figure out where we're going with it.
Mr. Chair, in your packet, you have a dash 4 amendment, and then what Carol is handing out right now is a dash 3 amendment. So, but the dash, to describe, briefly describe the dash 4 amendment, it's largely the dash 1 amendment with some technical fixes. And just to point those out, looking at the dash 4 in lines 2 and 3, it adds the language around a 3/5 majority. And it, the dash 1 amendment deleted the prior years for the phase-in, the age phase-in that occurred in the 90s. The dash 1 deleted that language. The dash 4 adds that back in just on the off chance that a tax return from those old years comes in without that language, then that person would be ineligible for the deductions. The dash 4 adds that back in. It also deletes the language pertaining to the inflation adjustment for the brackets. So that's not in the dash 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece, you can see on page 3 of the amendments, line 11, in terms of the intended spending, it refers to transportation services for seniors and people with disability. So other than that, the main thrust of the policies are the same as the dash 1.
Thank you. Representative Cowan, did you want to be heard this morning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for patiently waiting through the other bill.
Oh, no problem. It was very interesting. I actually have to rush back and read that bill. I have some issues myself that we might want to talk about. thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Jean Cowan. I am the representative from House District 10, the Central Oregon Coast, and as I think you're probably aware, some of the issues surrounding seniors and people with physical disabilities are pretty important to me this session. I really had been very happily setting out the conversations around the revenue piece of this and letting you good people work out how to find some revenue to help maintain some of our programs for this population. And then I'm really good at spending it, and I could figure out how we could do that. But as this is evolving, and this really is an evolving situation, all of the conversations that we had intensely post the 2007 session and throughout 2008 were in a different world than the one that we're living in right now. So I think everyone is scrambling to maintain a degree of flexibility that will allow us to address the issues as they change and as they occur. And it, although I haven't had a chance to go line by line through the amendments that you're looking at right now, I will do that. And that is absolutely the goal of those amendments. But what has come to my attention is on page 5 of the original bill in section 2, let's see, what line are we on here? Lines 15, 16, 17. Any revenue generated through this process is directed to go into the general fund and credited to the senior and disability service account. And as I've explored that a little bit, and I am not the expert on exactly how all of this works, but in general, and as best I understand it, that goes into the general senior and people with disabilities division of the Department of Human Services. And as such, the funding there then is subject to use in the rebalance process or any of the other things that occur within that rather massive department. It has been suggested that perhaps these funding should be directed into the Oregon Project Independence Fund, which is under ORS 410.422. This is a unique fund that generates interest and allows for other unexpected dollars, donations, other monies, and it ensures that the revenues stay in that fund for rather broad purposes, as well as I think I mentioned, the interest that gets generated. I've looked back at the statute around the expansion of the Oregon Project Independence, which is 410.435, and there are relatively broad parameters for expenditures in that fund. When we say the Oregon Project Independence Fund, I think all of us have a vision in our mind. OPI is... suddenly everybody's grabbing books. Isn't that interesting? 410.435.
And I'm making a note of it so that I can look it up later.
And I'm cheating because I'm looking at my copy of it. We have a vision that Oregon Project Independence, or if I could shorten that to OPI for purposes of this conversation, is home care, that it provides people to go into folks' homes. And it is broader than that. This talks about expanding the services under the OPI fund to include public education on long-term care planning and resources. It includes establishment of a website, long-term care case management, a variety of things. What it doesn't specifically include are some of the items that are focused on in, I believe, the Dash 4 around transportation, senior transportation. And so I'm not sure that it's an all-inclusive solution, but I think I just want to raise the question for us to explore a little more. Ultimately, the goal is the security, I believe, from many of our perspectives anyway, is the security of this source of funding. If we make adjustments in the senior medical exemption, that those funds need to be expended on the general population of seniors and people with physical disabilities if we're going to be successful in this shift. And what's the best way to dedicate those funds, and I'm using that word a little hesitantly because dedicated funds isn't exactly what I'm looking for, but a more generic description of their definition, ways to put that funding into programs that relate to services for seniors. And you might note that I've said this several times, seniors and people with physical disabilities, the developmentally disabled population and the services that we provide them are a separate conversation from the one that I've been working, which relates to seniors and people with physical disabilities, specifically because we have a number of people with physical disabilities who are aging in or not quite there and similarly relate to the programming that we're talking about. So that may be something that we would want to add into the verbiage. I think that the parameters of the OPI fund per se are fairly broad, but again, not all inclusive. So I think the quandary that we're looking at is the way to protect the funds in some way, but provide flexibility and to provide as broad a base as we can for meeting as many of the needs that we're seeing developed as possible at this point, and still holding on to the ability to make some changes as we go along, because we are in a really fast-changing and evolving situation, I believe, that we will be over the next biennium. So I'm not bringing forward specific amendment requests as much as a thought process, and wanted to throw that into people's minds, and I'm certainly more than willing to work with any and all of you on it offline or take any questions today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Questions for Representative Cowan? I would just note that one of the the points, I think, of the approach that you're suggesting on this bill and that I certainly agree with is that when we are looking at a tax break, which is widely misunderstood, it has a very different effect in the way it actually operates than what you would think just from the short description of it.
Right.
It tends to give very large tax breaks to wealthy individuals and very, very small tax breaks to lower-income individuals, while at the same time we are cutting programs that help people stay in their homes, get around, and in the case of the tax deferral program, actually pay their property taxes.
Right.
And it occurred to you, I think if I can put words in your mouth, it occurred to you, it certainly occurred to me, that one way of dealing with both of these issues was to put them together and fix what amounts to a very regressive tax break, and at the same time deal with the funding problem for other seniors. And I really appreciate your continuing to think about and struggle with this issue. I should say, committee, that when Representative Cowan came to me the other day, and I think it was yesterday, the issue really was, does this bill actually put the money into the correct fund? And that's something that we need to explore further. It's a technical problem rather than, I think, a policy one, but we want to make sure we get the bill right before we send it on to Ways and Means. And while this bill doesn't have a subsequent referral on it now, I don't think we can send it out without sending it to Ways and Means because of the attempt to set up a new fund or modify an old fund and put money in it, because the Ways and Means Committee will be the ones that will have to actually appropriate the funds to be spent. And that generated some comment? No. I've had a request to be heard from two other people, and I'd like to do that. Mary Johnson and Kelsey Wilson, are you here? If you would like to come forward, please do. And one would like to talk about, from the Lane Council of Government point of view, and the other from the Oregon Transit Association point of view. Please.
Mr. Chair, I have another half an hour or so, so I will stay close by.
Thank you. We appreciate that very much.
Representative Barnard, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me this impromptu opportunity.
And first, would you state your name, please?
Oh, I'm Mary Johnson. I'm from the advisory board of the Lane Council of Governments. I just want to tell you thank you for proposing this bill. My understanding is that this is a sort of a pay-as-you-go opportunity for seniors to support Representative Cowan's bill, which starts establishing preventive services. Certainly her bill is so much needed. I'm wholeheartedly in support of this, and I'm certainly very interested to hear what she just had to say about directing the funds, but I think that pay-as-you-go and preventive services are things that Oregon definitely needs, and thank you very much for doing this. I'm a member of the generation that pays the tax, and I know as a senior that people in my generation have had many opportunities that are not open to people who are young right now. And I certainly agree wholeheartedly, Representative Barnhart, with what you had to say about the effect of this tax. Certainly, I think that it is not much of an imposition on people who are in this income bracket. I certainly know the desperate need for Oregon Project independence, and what we need is to change the pyramid of care, because right now it's easy to get to the most expensive care, because if somebody's eligible for Medicaid, you can't deny them. But on the other hand, you can spend $250 a month, maybe, and help somebody stay in their own home and stay out of the Medicaid system. This is a change that we desperately need, and I thank you very much for this proposal.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelsey Wilson. I'm representing the Oregon Transit Association, and I want to thank you for the inclusion of transportation services for seniors and people with disabilities in this bill. Special needs transportation is currently funded by a 2-cent cigarette tax, an ID card fee, and what we call the lawnmower fund. It's a gas tax that doesn't go in cars and doesn't go on the for vehicles or things that don't use the highway. We are finding ourselves looking for funds in every direction. The ID card fee is losing revenue with some new provisions that for identification when you have to go and get your ID card. The cigarette tax, you're all aware, is becoming not a sustainable funding source because of what the feds have currently the new tax that the feds have imposed on the cigarette tax. And so this opportunity to be included in this bill is great for us. The need for special needs transportation is growing tremendously, and I would just like to add that this is a great fit for special needs transportation. It's seniors funding seniors, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about the need. I know I've spoken with many of you about this as we've been working on the cigarette tax that's been progressing, but this fund looks to be sustainable and would be a great fit for special needs transportation. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Question, Representative Call.
Yeah, Kelsey, if you could, I know that there are four of us who sit on transportation, but for the rest of us who aren't, could you please explain how much the special needs trips cost and how what kind of a burden that is on transit, the way the federal government's mandate with regards to that,
sure.
And then some of the ways in which transit districts have had to cope with that, specifically addressing the Salem issues?
Sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, that's a great question. Transit districts who provide fixed route service are currently mandated through the ADA to provide service within 3/4 of a mile of a fixed route for seniors and people with disabilities. A typical ride on a fixed route service costs the transit provider about $2 a ride. A special needs ride is anywhere from $22 to $30 a ride. It's a door-to-door dial-a-ride service, and so if you provide fixed route service, you have to provide the dial-a-ride service. Representative Call mentioned the Salem-Keizer issue. Salem-Keizer recently lost its Saturday service, and part of the reason for that is because the special needs rides are so costly, and if Salem-Keizer doesn't provide the fixed route service on the weekends, then they're not required to provide those expensive $28 rides on the weekends either. And it's a sad situation because just as many people need the fixed route service, and just as many of the people that use the fixed route service are seniors and people with disabilities that have been trained or have the ability to walk a few blocks to their stop, but there's also those people that can't use the fixed route service, and that's no longer an option for them on the weekends or in the evenings because the hours are being cut when service is provided. And that's happening in transit districts all across the state because of the lack of operational funds for transit and for special needs transportation.
Thank you. Do we also provide in some form some form of special needs transportation outside of the areas where the transit routes are? And if so, could you describe that a little bit?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do. We do provide those services. They're not a required service because there is no fixed route service. So in the rural areas, if there is no funding, then there is no service provided because it's not a mandated service. But there are providers all across the state that provide the dial-a-ride service for the special needs transportation. In eastern Oregon, they travel, you know, 2 or 3 hours sometimes to take people to their medical appointments. Yes, it is a service that's provided all across the state and in small rural areas as well as the areas where there's the fixed route service.
And do you know how those funds are administered from the state?
Yes, Mr. Chair, those funds that come from the cigarette tax, the ID card fee, and the lawnmower fee go through the Department of Transportation, and there was a fund established. It's called the Transportation Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund, and it's ORS 391.800, and that those are administered through the Public Transit Division, and there are about 42 special transportation service providers that then distribute those funds to the different service providers.
Right, and it is safe to yes, Representative.
Could you repeat that ORS?
The ORS number is it 391.800?
That's correct.
391.800, Representative. It is safe to say, isn't it, that all of the transit districts are taking funds that ought to belong to fixed route and using it in order to meet this federal mandate, and it's quite a bit more than the funds that they get from the state?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's true. Operating dollars from general operating funds are being moved to the special needs because the money from the elderly and disabled special transportation fund is far from covering costs on the service that they have to provide, and moving funds from their general operating is one way that they're dealing with it. The other way they're dealing with it is cutting routes and cutting service on their fixed routes so that they don't have to provide these services.
Ah, those two go together, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Other questions? Representative Call, does that help fill in the blank?
Yes, we've been discussing this quite at length in the Transportation Committee, and I just want to make sure that it's on the record as often and as thoroughly as possible.
Well, I'm personally very familiar with the issue because Lane Transit District made very certain that those of us from that area understood it, but there may be others who did not, and we appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Colleagues, unless there is something else to discuss on this morning. Representative Bruner, do you want to discuss the dash?
Sure, I will.
I know that wasn't the amendment you asked for.
Well, it may be, I found out from Chris. It's just it's hard to sort of glean. The dash 3 amendments, colleagues, do two things. One was a technical fix to the original bill, which I won't attempt to explain. If the committee is interested, I'm sure Chris could explain. The second thing that it does is adjust, and the best way to look at this would be to look at the sheet that was handed out last week or whenever we looked at this that shows the deduction phase out, the second box down there. And what the Dash 3 amendment would do is simply it would retain that deduction phase out, but would also adjust it for inflation, adjust it to the CPI. So in the first year, it would be, you know, anything over, for example, the highest amount there, anything over $80,000 is zero deduction. This would move that number and all the other numbers up in line with the consumer, with inflation as time goes on. And the reason for this, Mr. Chair and colleagues, is that, you know, 20 years from now, $80,000 is going to be significantly less than it is today, as all the numbers. So,
if we're fortunate.
Yeah.
Well,
if we end
sure.
up with a recession, with a deflationary recession that takes a long time, that will not be
I'm hoping in 20 years things sort themselves out, Mr. Chair.
That is something I think we all agree with.
And Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative.
Health care costs, I think, are most assuredly $80,000 in health care costs, no matter what our economic state, is going to be significantly less 20 years from now.
Yeah. Chris, could you point out where in the Dash 3 that, because I know it's sort of strange how it's done.
How it achieves
how the inflation? Yeah, exactly.
Sure. And if you're looking at the dash three, page 2, lines 24 through 25, the language in the amendment refers to deleting limit on and then inserting upper and lower dollar amounts. Where that refers to in the bill, the draft of the bill is on page 3, line 3. So right now, reading in part, the bill is drafted, the Department of Revenue shall make a cost of living adjustment to the limit on the medical expense. In the draft bill, the limit refers to the $6,000, and that's the cap. So by deleting the limit on and inserting the upper and lower, it would read, the Department of Revenue shall make a cost of living adjustment to the upper and lower dollar amounts of each of the income brackets used to phase out. So that's how it achieves that policy.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay. But you mostly use this language already in the bill.
Yes, the CPI used is in the existing. It doesn't fill in the blanks currently, but the method is, yes, correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Anything else this morning? If not, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2069. And we have, again, exhausted our agenda. You have about an hour before session. With that, we are adjourned.
Right. Okay, so you know what you're doing.